You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Ah, bruh.
From the crate, thanks to your friendly neighbourhood record store, Southbound Records.
Hey ho, hi. As somebody called in this morning, Troy, and farewelled me on the phone saying, yabba dabba doo. So, hello, Troy.
Not the Flintstones.
I think it was done awesome. So, thanks to that listener for brightening up my morning. And hello, Troy.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. How are you this
Excellent.
Morning?
Excellent.
Fantastic.
We've got some good stuff today.
We always have some good stuff.
Well, we've got even more good stuff today then, don't we? We're going to start with something from Tanarawin. Now, you know Tanarawin.
Yes, I do.
Yes, and I'm sure the listeners do too. Tanarawin are a group... how shall we explain them?
I think you're going to be way better at explaining it than I am.
No, probably not. Anyway, Tanarawin, basically, these are a group made up of Tuareg people. Now, the Tuareg people came from the northeast of Mali, alongside the border of Algeria. There's a mountain range there that runs through the Sahara Desert. And traditionally, Tuareg were nomadic people of that area. However, with Mali undergoing civil wars and uprisings, you know, going back to the 60s and probably before, Tuareg people have been mostly displaced.
Right.
So Tanarawin, which is a word which means desert or empty space, it's basically everything that they've done as a group has been related in some manner to their homeland or lack of their homeland. So this is rebel music at its finest.
Mm-hmm.
They started. Do you know all of this? Have you watched the documentary?
I don't know this.
Well, they initially came together as a group when they were in a training camp, a military training camp run by Colonel Gaddafi.
Really?
In Algeria, yeah.
My goodness.
But you know, it was like forced military training. Mm-hmm. I think Gaddafi had wanted to get a bunch of Tuareg warriors on his side. Anyway, this is all beside the point when it comes to their music. What kind of music do they play? Now, this is interesting. It's basically the thread which runs through it is a West African kind of music, which, as we know, is related to the American blues. Though in the case of Tanarawin, they hadn't actually heard American blues music till 2001. No idea.
Wow.
You know, they had heard stuff before, like Hendrix.
Yeah.
They'd even heard stuff like Dire Straits and things like this. But they hadn't actually heard, like, the blues and didn't really know that there was that connection. You know, the same thing happened with Ali Fakature, who didn't know that what he was playing was so closely related to, say, what John Lee Hooker was playing. Anyway, Tanarawin, over the, you know, being displaced, has fed into all their music, but specifically this one. A few years ago, Mali had, like, they were able to return to Mali, but a Islamist group had, like, risen up and said there can be no devil's music anymore, and specifically targeting them, they had to leave. You know, they had to, like, get out.
What was it about their music that didn't get a good response?
Well, with you know, I mean, I can't speak for Islamists really, but you know, I think that it means basically if it's not from the Quran, then it's
right.
Probably evil.
Yep.
You know. But anyway, so and during this time when they had to leave again, some of them relocated to the Joshua Tree Desert in California, where Rancho de la Luna is, which is the Queens of the Stone Age related studio. And we've had one EP already that was recorded there. Now, this album, the new album L1, means elephants in Tuareg.
Cool.
Or in Tamashek, sorry. This one, that what they've done is they've got some of the recordings from there, some which they made in Paris, and some when they went and based themselves in Mohamed El Ghazana in Morocco, and recorded some stuff there as well. Now, the other thing is it the same members? Well, no. Tanarawin is kind of like a collective where a lot of people can be involved. For example, in the Moroccan recordings, you have like a whole bunch of local kids who are on the recording as well. In the case of the recordings at Joshua Tree, you have Mark Lanigan from Screaming Trees, Queens of the Stone Age. You have Kurt Vile, Alan Johannes, who was in Queens for a while.
So there's a variation of
There's other contributors. People, but, and you know, they're not the first Westerners who've played with the group before. You know, in the past, Saul Williams has done stuff with them. Tunde Adebimpe and Kit Malone from TV on the Radio have recorded with them. But what you have is not like Western Guest brings their Western styles.
And they have to incorporate or use the styles that are traditional to the band?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think it'd be reductive to say that what Tin Arrowin do is specifically traditional.
No, but like their sound, they have to incorporate the sound of... Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, yeah. They play that music. Yeah. They don't say, "Hey, here's a let's do Johnny Be Good,"
yeah,
or anything like that. The song we're going to play, we're going to hear a good example of that, which has Kurt Vile on it.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, I didn't know Kurt Vile was on this one until you said just when we came in.
Oh really?
No, I didn't know. I mean, you couldn't tell.
And why can't you tell?
Well, you're just about to hear. This one is called Te Waiin.
Let's play it. Hopefully it's going to play. Sorry. Give me a second.
Were you?
There we are, Tanarawin.
There we are.
That's the opening track from their new album, L1, or Elwin. It's out tomorrow worldwide, and we'll have it in on LP.
And you just briefly mentioned how they'd been nominated, or they won, or they got nominated for a Grammy a couple of years ago.
They won a Grammy in 2012.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah, for the Tassili album, which is, was it the studio album before last? This is their seventh studio record.
Really?
Yeah. But
so why is it, like, I mean, for me personally, why is it just now that I'm starting to hear about them more? Maybe is it because I'm not as haven't been as involved in the past, or are they starting to kind of collect more of a fan base or more of a following?
Well, they've basically been on tour worldwide for the last, you know, 15 years just about. You know, they did the WOMAD type festivals and that kind of thing, but they're like a big festival draw card, in particularly in Europe. And in the United States. I don't know why you haven't heard of them.
I don't know why either, Troy, but I'm really delighted to be able to be listening to them now.
Well, there you go.
What are we going to be looking at next?
Okay, we're going to move backwards into the past now. In fact, we're going to move backwards twice into the past.
Cool.
Initially, let me just start from the beginning. In the early 90s, there was something which people now know as the acid jazz movement, which basically like started with a record label called Acid Jazz, but it like fed into a whole bunch of other things. And you had groups like the Brand New Heavies or even stuff like Incognito that was like chucked into the same under the same umbrella. And kind of what it was regardless of the name, which is kind of a goofy name, acid jazz, it related just as much to soul and funk music from the past, which had been like brought into the present in the modernist way of doing something for now, right? So around that time, three gentlemen, Eddie Piller and Dean Rudland and Tony Morrow, I think it was the third one, decided that they were going to like do some compilations of what they called blue breakbeats. Now, they decided it was called this because it was concentrating on the great Blue Note label between about 65 and 75, 1975. Mm-hmm. And what they were going to do is not just go, hey, this will be great for the people who like our acid jazz type stuff. They thought, what if we've seen the way that this stuff is fed into our scene, we've seen the way that it's fed into hip hop. Let's go for these tunes, which have either been sampled by hip hop artists of late, or should be sampled by hip hop artists. And that was, I think that was the important qualifier. It wasn't just a case of like putting together some things that someone else had the idea of using. It was putting together things which people could use along the same lines. And the Blue Note label the Blue Note label, what you think of being Blue Note and the Blue Note sound, basically your thoughts will go immediately towards pre-1967 when it was still an independent label. 67, Alfred Lion sold it to Liberty, and not the tone of the label, but the operation of the label changed quite a lot.
Okay.
I think Liberty wanted, rather than going for the art or the jazz, they wanted to like go for something that was going to sell.
And but did they kind of rediscover their art, I suppose?
The art never went away.
Yeah.
It just wasn't the reason for being anymore.
Right.
So what happened is like going from like sort of a post bebop style, which had characterized what the label sounded like before, it moved into what became known as soul jazz, became known as funk, although not like James Brown funk, but mm-hmm. a jazz kind of funk, but not jazz funk. Jeez, listen to all these qualifiers. Anyway, that was the kind of sound which like took Blue Note through to the early 70s before it finally went away in 75, I think. But the kind of music that was being made, even though a lot of the same artists who had previously recorded for the label were doing something rather different. And what's wrong? Nothing. Sorry, there's just looks of horror in the room.
No.
What was I going to say? Oh, the artists, right.
You get too easily distracted, Troy.
Yes, I do. The artists that are put together on these compilations, Blue Breakbeats, now there was four of them, I think, that three of them are being reissued tomorrow. And you can either buy it as like a brick-sized 3-CD set or as a three double LPs, which are all on different coloured vinyl. There's a blue there's a set with blue vinyl, there's a set with yellow vinyl, there's a set with red vinyl. Yeah, see, there's your eyes lighting up, distracted by the idea of
a... I'm looking at the case.
Oh, this is I brought in the CD for you.
And it's got a blue, a red,
and a yellow.
Yeah. So
there you
sense.
Go. That's kind of what it is.
And it's got a mass amount of music on it.
It does. Now, the one we're going to hear is by a man called Grant Green. Now, Grant Green had started out as a jazz guitar player in the early 60s, you know, along the similar lines to Kenny Burrell or Wes Montgomery. Mm. And I think most people nowadays would consider his defining sort of moment as being a 1965 release called Idle Moments, which is a tremendous record. But what we're going to hear is from a little bit later. Now, this is from 1970. Grant Green made his first live album called Alive. You wouldn't know that it was live from the recording. Significantly on it, the drummer was Idris Muhammad, who had previously been Leo Morris. The reason you know Idris Muhammad is because you like Jamie XX.
Yeah.
And that Loud Places song is a sort of a looped sample of an Idris Muhammad song called
Really?
Could Heaven Ever Be Like This?
Yeah. Wow. Okay, that... Wow.
Okay, so Idris Muhammad is on there. Who plays keys on this? It's Ronnie Laws. But why I chose this one specifically is because it, not simply that it was like sampled by, I think, A Tribe Called Quest used this, but because every aspect of this, every element of this, which was recorded in 1970, really spoke to the time of 1990 to 1993 when mm-hmm. the acid jazz thing was happening. It was like a present moment was transplanted across the decades. And even now, this far away from 1990s, it still kind of feels like a very alive kind of music, even though all the people who played on this are now dead. But,
gosh,
shall we hear it?
We'll yeah.
Okay, the tune we're going to hear is Suki Suki, which was composed by Don Covey, a great R&B singer, and Steve Cropper from Booker T and the MGs. So already you know that it's going to be something outside of jazz.
Let's do it. We'll be right back. don't know. That music just makes me feel really good.
Yeah, it's supposed to. Suki Suki, that's by Grant Green. It is being re-released on the fantastic series of compilations, Blue Breakbeats, on the Blue Note label. And really weirdly, it says in the liner notes here that something that I could never have guessed. Dean Rudlin in the liner notes said that when the Blue Note 75th anniversary happened about 2 or 3 years back now, a book came out called Uncompromising Expression, fantastic history of Blue Note, and it said in it that he was thrilled that not only was this compilation and series of compilations mentioned, he was also thrilled to discover, which he didn't know, that this compilation that put together had sold over 1 million.
Whoa, my goodness.
But that doesn't mean that every one of you have a copy, and you're now able to go and buy one of the three sets, or all of the three sets.
I reckon if you're going to do it, you got to buy all of them.
Yeah, you liked the vibraphone in the back of that, didn't you?
Yeah, I heard it very faintly, but there was just something about it that kind of, I don't know, it added something that you wouldn't realize the song needed.
I think that was a smashing example of the kind of soul jazz that was coming out in the late 60s and early 70s. Mm. Really, if you haven't investigated Blue Note stuff beyond the obvious massive things that you would have, like Coltrane's Blue Train or Cannonball Adderley's Something Else, the label is well worth following through. Mm. Even some of the stuff that Donald Byrd did with the Mizells on the Blue Note label, there's a series of three albums. Donald Byrd, who had like completely made a transition from doing like a post-bop stuff with the Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers back in the day, completely made a transformation, like right through sort of soul jazz and funk into disco, but a kind of really smart sort of disco. And I think, Hannah, you would particularly like
I do have a big,
well, you like the Blackbirds, didn't you?
Yeah, I do,
right, which was of course Donald's students.
You'll have to write it down for me.
I think I will. Shall we move along?
Yes.
More reissues. Now, late last year, there was a box set released called Who Can I Be Now? 1974 to 1976, Dave Bowie. Right? So that came out as a box set on both vinyl and CD, and the chances are you didn't buy it because it was it might have seemed like quite an expensive thing. Luckily, the way these things go, that box set has the breakout releases, which is a lot of the key things from there are now going to be available from this Friday separately. So what you get is you can get the Diamond Dogs album, David Live, or as Dave Bowie said, that should be called David Dead. Nassau Coliseum, previously a bootleg, but quite a nice live performance from 75 or 76 rather. Station to Station, Young Americans, and a special release which hasn't come out before is a 7-inch picture disc of Sound and Vision, with a different version of Sound and Vision on the flip that was made for some Sony advert where they stripped everything back and it's basically just Bowie's vocal and piano. Quite nice. But I figured that what we should do is just play something, not because everyone knows it, but because I think that, you know, that 24 months saw a change basically from Bowie being the sort of the Ziggy glam rock guy into this glacial European sort of Station to Station thing. I don't even know what kind of music that was, and through there he'd like gone through soul and funk as well with Young Americans. But I think that you can really hear the breadth of what was to come on the Diamond Dogs record from 1974. I mean, he'd broken up the Spiders from Mars. Instead of replacing Mick Ronson as a guitar player, he decided he was going to play all the guitar. Instead of getting someone to produce, decided he was going to produce. And in the way that all great Dave Bowie things came out, it came out via thwarted plans. Diamond Dogs was originally going to be his musical version of George Orwell's 1984. The estate said, no, you can't do that. And he goes, oh my God, I've got a bunch of these songs, what am I going to do? So he decided to basically sketch a narrative and like put it together as Diamond Dogs, where the city in 1984 was replaced by a post-apocalyptic place called Hunger City, where kids run around in rags on rooftops, etc., etc. But I think the album what I said about it, like showing the breadth of what was to come, is that you had some of the funk on there on the June 1984 with the Isaac Hayes type strings and the Shaft type guitar. You also had like Where It Come From with Rebel Rebel, the kind of glam type thing. But also, weirdly enough, looking right forward to 76 and nothing to do with Dave Bowie, was he said around 76 or 77 that in Diamond Dogs, the kind of people running around, they're sort of juvenile delinquent wrecks, as he said in a different song, that he was thinking of, were kind of the people like Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious and Steve Jones and all the kids that came out of punk. So, kind of looking ahead.
To wrap it up,
Diamond Dogs, Dave Bowie, title track, LP out tomorrow.
Thank you so much, Troy, for coming in, and I'm excited to hear this track, and we'll see you next week.
Most likely.
Well, most definitely.
Okay.
I'm just trying to play it. There we are.
From the crate, thanks to Southbound Records, 132 Simon Street, next to T White Spikes.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.